We have Luke Broden in studio, two-term mayor of the city of Hartford, running for the Democratic nomination in the 1st Congressional District. It's John Larson's seat for some 28 years, and we've got a couple other people, Jack Perry, Ruth Fortune, you know, who we haven't really had much updates from their campaigns. We had Jillian Gilchrist, state rep, in studio a little bit before. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm good. So, I mean, I know you're doing teaching and you do some consultancy, but, like, I mean, how, June is the convention and then August would be the primary.
Yep.
So what are you doing on a daily basis right now? Is it all about the money? Is it about, are you talking to people behind the scenes? Like, talk about your day campaign.
Sure. I mean, every day is different, but it's a lot of things. I mean, as you said, I'm still teaching. I'm still teaching law school. I'll be doing that through this semester. But it's all the things that go into building a campaign. I mean, over the last month or month and a half, a lot of it has been out there trying to help and support municipal candidates around the district. You know, we just had the elections last week. You had a lot of really competitive races in the first district and a lot of great candidates and a lot of great candidates who won. But, you know, I spent a lot of time out there door knocking, phone calling, you know, helping rally the base and, and then also a lot of time on the phone, and some of that's raising money. Some of it's reaching out to active Democrats who might be, you know, among the potential delegates to the convention in the spring or in the early summer. And then a lot of it's just getting out there and getting, you know, face to face. And I think as now that the municipal races are done, a lot more of it is going to be small gatherings, house parties, just getting in front of people and having open, you know, conversations and sharing why I'm doing this and taking questions and making sure that people get a chance to, you know, to really, you know, ask whatever they want to ask.
You can get the nomination outright. You can get 15% or more, and those both get you on the primary ballot, as would, I think, 3,700 signatures. Is there a window of time you have to get those?
You can't start collecting them until after the convention. But look, I feel very confident that I'm going to be on the ballot at the convention. I think the convention is going to be a tightly contested thing. You know, I think you've got to assume that a 28-year incumbent has a major advantage among that insider crew.
Right.
But, you know, I think there's a real hunger for change out there, even among active Democrats. So I'm very confident we're going to get on the ballot at the convention. And you know, and then from the start of this, this race has always been about that August primary. You know, I think that
– Well, that really is the election, let's be honest.
Right.
The Republican right now isn't even living in the district, right? So, I mean, how do you make your pitch to – you know, someone who's voted for Larson in the past?
Well, I do it, you know, many, many times a day. And it starts, as I've shared with you before, right? It starts with saying, I've got an enormous amount of respect for John Larson. I've worked closely with him. I like him. I appreciate the work that he's done for almost 28 years. But I think at this moment, we have a fundamentally different conception of what this job requires. You know, in this moment, the job of a Democratic member of Congress is not just sort of inside the committee rooms or, you know, slapping backs in the cloakroom. The job of a member of Congress is to be out there carrying a message with clarity, with focus, with energy every single day, everywhere you can. And by the way, not just in friendly territory, you know, not just on MSNBC or, you know, in Democratic town committee meetings, but going on Fox News, going on the podcasts, going off of VFW Hall and making the case that what Donald Trump is doing, enabled by a Republican Congress that has completely capitulated, is damaging our country in countless ways. And as a Democratic Party, we actually have a vision to make life better and easier and more affordable. And if you're not doing that every single day, then I think you're not doing your job as a member of Congress. And I just don't see that. But there's other stuff too. You know, it's – look – I would be proud to be a fighter to protect and defend Social Security, but it cannot be the only thing we're talking about. And for the last 5-8 years, it's the only thing I've heard John talk about.
Was the election earlier in the month affirming for all the things you're talking about?
Well, I think it showed that people want to express how they feel. And look, what I'll say is, as part of those municipal elections, I was out there talking with lots of Democrats. And not just the folks who are active on Democratic town committees, but actually knocking on doors, just running into people, having conversations. And what I heard back was 100 different versions of the way I feel, which is love John Larson, but it's time.
So listen, I don't think after this election, all of a sudden the Democratic Party has their act together and all of a sudden the Republicans are a mess. I want to get a little bit more drilled down into the party itself, because we had a very wide range of candidates do very well in this election, from, you know, extremely progressive to very, very moderate. So we'll talk more about that with Luke Bronin, again, the two-term mayor of Hartford running for the Democratic nomination in the 1st Congressional District. We'll take a break here. And again, we recently had Jillian Gilchrist in. We've talked to Ruth Fortune and Jack Perry and, of course, John Larson, as we will go all the way through the convention in June, then the primary in August, and then the election in November for the 1st Congressional District here in Connecticut. It's a fascinating race. Democratic candidates don't get primaried here in Connecticut, and Larson's getting primaried by four people. Luke Bronin, two-term mayor of Hartford, joining us in studio here for the rest of the program. First of all, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Always.
So you mentioned the election, and I'm curious what your fundamental takeaway, before I project any of my own opinion, from what seemed like even Republicans admitted kind of was a bit of a blue wave earlier this month.
Yeah, I think it was a powerful blue wave, and I think it was a couple of things. It was the fact that, you know, voters are once again, you know, being reminded that Trump equals chaos. And voting against that, I think a lot of it in a lot of places was affordability. You know, you had
there's the word,
right? But it's real, and it's not just a word. It's the fact that, you know, the combination of healthcare and housing and electricity and child care and taking care of your parents if you have to, with all of that stuff together, it's crushing for like so many families. And so, and you had a president who ran on that last year, but who has done nothing to actually make things better since he became president. In fact, you know, everything that he's done has arguably made it worse, from tariffs to, you know, the chaos to the unpredictable, you know, way he's managed the economy. So to exploding the debt, right? So I think some of that was a rejection of the Republicans, but also especially in these local races and the state races, you also had Democrats who were out there just talking about their vision for their community or their vision for their state. And I think that's the formula we need at the national level. We need to shine a light at the on the damage that Trump's doing, but that's not enough. Well, we also have to make sure that we're laying out the vision for how we're going to make life better and easier and healthier and more affordable. And I think you saw that combination in the local and state races, and the mission has to be to have that same, you know, duo in the races next fall.
So I sort of separate – I mean, Connecticut's so blue, it's almost hard to glean anything from it. And but, you know, when you go to Virginia, purple, New Jersey, mostly blue, but still less blue than Connecticut. You know, I listen to Plain English with Derek Thompson a lot, and he had somebody on who basically said, you know, the messaging was better for the Democrats this time because, you know, household debt is historically low and household income, you know, wages are way up, that there is an affordability problem, but it's the narrative isn't 100%. In that camp. But what I wanted to ask you is that, you know, you have Mamdani in New York, right, who is, you know, on the extreme side of progressives. And then you have Spanberger in Virginia, moderate, and Mikey Sherrill, who wins in New Jersey. The first question I have for you is, like, do you support Zohran Mamdani?
I think that he brought a level of energy and focus to the affordability problem that was really, really important.
What about politics?
Well, I mean, that's a huge, broad, you know, broad set of things that are covered in there. I'm not convinced that, you know, look, do I think that we should be delivering free child care in this country or actually affordable child care? Yeah, I think we should be doing that everywhere. You know, do I think that we should have buses that are fast and reliable and clean and good service? Yeah, I think the same thing about trains. You know, I also think that, you know, markets work and markets can work if you help manage them carefully. I think that, you know, there's the big question for a mayor, though, is not where are you on the ideological spectrum. It's what kind of team are you building to just get the basic stuff done. You know, you talk about the old version of, you know, the sewer socialists, the people, you know, back in the 40s and later who had really progressive policies, but were running cities and were focused on just delivering core services better. I think the focus for Mamdani has got to be on just delivering the core services of a city effectively, and that'll be the measure of success for a mayor. But back to the bigger question, look, you've got an incredibly broad range of policy views reflected in the Democratic camp. I think that's good. I think it's good that you've got
– What does the party stand for? I guess my point is, like, I don't know what is the Democratic Party stand for, because you have such a wide range of people who did well on Election Day. And you could say it's good, but what's the unifying message?
So I think the unifying message should be that we want America to be a place where you can actually get your head above water, where you can actually get stable and your kids can do better than you. And it also should be that we're not screwing over our kids and our grandkids by, you know, letting billionaires and people who are making tens or hundreds of millionaires – $1 million a year get away with not paying their fair share while we're racking up deficits, underinvesting in education, letting our infrastructure crumble compared to the rest of the world. Like, we want to be – America to be a place where – economic opportunity actually is real, and we can be proud of what our government is doing to make life better. And that to me is the fundamental vision. It's about fairness and it's about opportunity. And I'm not troubled at all that there are, you know, different Democrats with different formulas running in different places. What works in New York doesn't necessarily work in Jared Golden's seat in Maine, you know, or in Marie Glusenkamp Perez's seat out west. But in the coming years, we're going to have presumably a big, crowded, raucous presidential primary. And you're going to have a bunch of different visions and voices battling it out to lead the Democratic Party. And I think that is a good and healthy thing. And I hope that we have more Democrats who are bringing the kind of energy that we saw from Zora Mamdani, who are bringing, you know, that willingness to just engage with people in a real way, regardless of the politics, just engage in an honest, energetic, serious way and show that, you know, as a Democratic Party, we're actually trying to make things better.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's a fascinating topic. I think whatever government you want, I want to be able to pay for it. Like,
yeah.
To me, that's my biggest issue. So, I don't support Mamdani or not support Mamdani. I'm just saying that, you know, busing is a fascinating thing, because I actually have said it here in Connecticut. I think busing should be free. If you are working hard enough and you don't make enough you have to take a bus, then you need help. Like, why wouldn't we want to help that person? So I've never minded underwriting that kind of stuff. We have to pause there. It's really interesting. We'll talk a little bit more about the race in the first congressional district and maybe a little bit more about the national approach, because I'm curious about your take on the shutdown and what you would do or would have done if you were in John Larson's position in D.C. over the last couple of months. Luke Bronin, the two-term mayor of Hartford, again running for the Democratic nomination in the first congressional district. We'll continue with him in a few minutes. We're back here with Luke Bronin, two-term mayor of the city of Hartford, running for the Democratic nomination in the first congressional district against John Larson. And then you have Southington's Jack Perry, Hartford's Ruth Fortune, and West Hartford State Rep Jillian Gilchrist involved. You know, getting back to Washington, if you were in John Larson's position the last couple of months, how would you have handled what's going on? And what do you think of this whole, like, did Schumer capitulate and all that kind of stuff? Just talk about the shutdown.
Yeah. So let me take the second part first. I do think Schumer capitulated. I think it was a huge mistake. And look, I think it's time for Schumer to go. I think it's time for the Democratic Party to find a new leader in the Senate. And there are a bunch of things that I think were mistakes here. I mean, one, this felt like Democrats caving at the moment of maximum leverage. You know, post-election, you had Donald Trump himself standing up the podium and saying, acknowledging that the American people recognize that when the Republicans have the White House and the Senate and the House, that the shutdown is on them and holding them responsible for it. You had Donald Trump, who was showing his, you know, level of callousness by using hunger of tens of millions of Americans as political leverage, at the same time that he's demolishing the East Wing of the White House to build a ballroom and having, you know, great Gatsby-themed parties in Mar-a-Lago. I mean, it was just full display, both the ineffectiveness and the callousness of Trump and of the Republican Party that was enabling him. And you had a rejection of it by millions of voters. And that was the moment that Democrats in the Senate, you know, eight of them, not the majority of them, not even close to the majority of them, but eight of them voted to capitulate. And without getting anything that they had said they were fighting for all this time. You know, this was about trying to keep healthcare premiums from skyrocketing for millions of people. And so I think it was a huge mistake to do that. But what was deeply frustrating is this fiction that Chuck Schumer, you know, didn't at least with a wink and a nod bless this. I mean, his number two, the number two Democrat in the Senate, Dick Durbin, who is the minority whip, one of the key people in Chuck Schumer's leadership team voted for it.
Who's retiring.
And nobody can tell me that, you know, that means one of two things. Either it means that Chuck Schumer, this was a carefully choreographed thing where Schumer said, I'm going to vote against it. You guys go for it. And then we'll all pretend, you know, that I was opposed to it.
Or he
could not control not just his caucus, but his own leadership team. So, but beyond that, it's just time for a different generation of leaders who are communicating in a different way, who are able to get the message out. And back to the first question you raised about, you know, what should John Larson do? What should others be doing? We knew this shutdown was coming for months. We've known it since March. And so, I was glad to see Democrats finally coalescing around a real message, and it was about healthcare affordability. I wish we'd done that months before. I wish every Democrat had been out there saying, here are the stakes, here's what's coming and here's what we're going to fight for. We got there, but I think we got there a little bit late.
Well, let me just say, because, you know, listen, I try to think of these things objectively and not, you know, and I try to be sensitive. I think healthcare is a right, not a privilege, but I don't like the government involved in it. And so what I would have liked, maybe they recognized a couple of months ago, let's improve the way it's done in a way that doesn't have to put subsidies there in perpetuity. Just like you have to admit, there's got to be some waste and fraud within SNAP. I mean, you know, like, I think it's good to maybe we should, like, the one thing it brought to my attention is that I think if people need help, they should get help. But I think we should also be auditing what we're doing. You know, I think there's a lot of parts of this that it brought to – I had no idea how big it was. I had no idea.
Well, there is a bigger question is why in the richest country in the world are 42 million Americans in a position where they can't put enough food on the table? Right, that's a more fundamental question about the kind of economy we've built in this country, where you have an enormous concentration of wealth, where you have massive growth at the top, and where you have 42 million Americans who can't put food on the table. That's a pretty fundamental question that raises. But look, Brian, I don't think you find anybody who would say we shouldn't be finding fraud and waste and abuse. But that's not what that was about. That was about using hunger as a leverage. And you say you don't want the government involved in healthcare. Medicare? Medicaid, the VA coverage. Right, I mean, let's just – but
the government,
we're involved in massive ways. But one of the things we're not doing is building a healthcare system that actually makes any sense.
But can we though? I'm beginning to think it's not possible.
Well, why don't we look beyond our borders? There's lots of countries that are getting way better health outcomes for way less money. So this isn't like some theoretical thing that we can't possibly find an example of a healthcare system that is both more efficient and more effective.
That as constructed, Obamacare might not be the answer to what you're talking about.
Obamacare was a partial victory because it couldn't get anything more, but it left a lot of things undone. It left a lot of, for example, ability to control costs in the healthcare system. You know, that's still a huge problem. There's still lots of Americans who are struggling with deductibles, you know, or copays that are really hard to manage.
It just feels like the U.S. government's underwriting the profits of the healthcare industry. That's what it looks
like. So I think you're right. And that means we have to be serious about healthcare reform. What Trump has been focused on is dismantling Obamacare because it's been his white whale since he came into office and he wants to chip away at it. That's not about making healthcare better for the American people. And that's the frustration. To me, you know, when people talk about the difference between the parties, to me, it's a vast difference. And the difference is that we may not always get it right, but Democrats are trying to build an economy and government that actually works for people. And I think that Trump is mostly either distorting or dismantling, you know, the economy in a way that doesn't work for people.
I think subsidizing the system isn't the way to go. Just like I think that, you know, we need to reduce our debt because we pay so much in debt service, it's going to strangle our country. But I do – I mean, the one thing that the Republicans have not come up with an actual healthcare plan as an alternative. And to me, that's the biggest sort of void. It was promised in the first term and it hasn't even been promised now. And without an alternative proposal, what are you going to do? We only have a little bit of time left with Luke Bronin, two-term Hartford mayor running for the Democratic nomination in the first congressional district. You know, you talked about how if you were in Congress, you would have tried to address this sooner to avoid this kind of – this sort of cliff we've fallen off, and we'll figure out what happens when – if and when it gets through the House. Two quick questions. One is, would you – it goes back to the House. Would you be voting for it? Like, what would you be doing now?
No, I wouldn't be voting for it.
Then it's going to continue?
It's going to pass. But no, I think that we should – this is a moment where I think there are even Republicans recognizing that they don't want healthcare premiums to spike. Healthcare premiums are about to spike for lots of Americans in blue states and in red states. And I think the Republicans, there are a bunch of Republicans in Congress who were who know that and who saw that coming and who ultimately would have begun to put pressure on their leadership and on Trump to say, let's actually get something done here. And instead, by voting for this deal when they did, I think what the Democratic eight, you know, plus Schumer, who I think blessed this, did is they basically sent a message to the Republicans, don't ever go against Trump because ultimately everybody's going to cave to him.
I think that's true. I think they also realized that the Republicans, if Trump wasn't going to waver, the Republicans weren't going to move and we'd be stuck here forever. We only have a minute left. You talked about, you know, I think Congressman Larson would have a similar position on what you just said. So like what other ways, finally, just your last statement before we talk again, that's not necessarily a distinguishing factor from you and the congressman. But, you know, when you talk to people who may have voted for him 10 times, you know, again, what are the things you're saying to them to distinguish yourself?
So, you know, one of John's arguments for why he should go back there after 28 years is seniority. And that's basically saying I should go back because I've been there so long. And I, with all due respect, John has not gained influence in Congress in the last 10 years. He's not in line to be chair of a major committee. He's not second in line to be chair of a major committee. His number one issue has been the Social Security bill that he's introduced every year for the last 12 years. And even when he was the chairman of the Social Security Committee and we had the Democrats had the White House and the Senate and the House, his own bill didn't even get a vote. Time does not equal effectiveness. And in our politics right now, what would be more effective would be to have a new generation of leaders who are bringing a different kind of energy and focus and clarity to the work.
Thanks, Luke. Appreciate the time.
Thank you.